Yes.
Thank you, Justin.
Thank
you.
You.
Thank you, everyone.
Thank you, everyone.
Have anyone haven't been here last week?
Yeah.
Okay.
Alright. Cool. Well, we thought would I put a slideshow together.
Because things are always easier with pictures. Saves us from talking. And we just thought we'd give a very high level introduction to Theravada Buddhism and just all the very superficial aspects of it, and we'll leave the deep stuff to Jim's capable hands next week. So
superficial, but 17 pages.
17 pages. Oh, pictures. Just to get an understanding, who would say they're very new to Buddhism and have not heard much about Buddhism before? And
who is a metta center is the first point or stop point of you in experiencing Buddhism?
Okay.
So when you say you're quite new, what is your first encounter with Buddhism? What is your name?
My name is Priyo.
Yeah,
I'm not as
quiet.
I just
want to listen
for
the
voice,
okay?
Just...
Yeah, sure.
And
I'll
answer the questions
later.
No worries.
Yeah.
So.
And how about you?
Ying? Oh, no, I missed the list of your questions. So just ignore me, sorry.
Did you come across Buddhism from Metta Center?
Yeah.
That's cool. Just wondering how to sort of talk about the topic tonight, that's all. So, what is Theravada Buddhism? So, you might have seen different types of monastics in different type of robes, and there's all these different schools of Buddhism. And if you came last week, we've got an introduction, but unfortunately we weren't there last week, so I'm not really sure what we talked about, so we might have covered some of the material as well. But the name Theravada comes from the original Pali, which it's described as the doctrine of the elders, and it's the name of the school of Buddhism that draws its inspiration from the Pali Canon. And the Pali Canon, Pali is a language that is closest to the language that the Buddha spoke when he was around, and a lot of his teachings were recorded and passed down in the Pali language. And Theravada Buddhism is predominant currently in Southeast Asia, so mostly you'd see Theravada Buddhism in Burma, Thailand, Cambodia, Laos, Sri Lanka, and sometimes in Vietnam as well. And it's also distinct from the other type of schools of Buddhism, which is Mahayana Buddhism, where you'd see more in East Asia, as well as Tibetan or Vajrayana Buddhism, which is predominant in Tibet and Inner Mongolia. So you can sort of see how Buddhism sort of spread from India, where the Buddha taught, and then it went down to Sri Lanka and towards the east. And in the current day, Buddhism is no longer in India. It's spread all over the world, actually. And how Theravada Buddhism had its origins was, in the beginning, when the Buddha was around, there was no different schools of Buddhism. There was no Theravada Buddhism, there was no Mahayana Buddhism. There was only the Buddha's teachings. And initially, when he gave his teachings, he had an attendant called Ananda, and Ananda had a really amazing memory, and he would remember pretty much everything the Buddha taught. So after the Buddha passed away, 2,500 years ago, the enlightened disciples of the Buddha, about 500 enlightened disciples of the Buddha, came together and decided to put together the Buddha's teachings.
Yeah, and you must add that too, that back then, 2,500 years ago, there is no written language.
Mm-hmm.
So everything would be oral transport. So let's say there's no way to record apart from, you know, memorize and reciting it.
Mm. Yes, and so how do we know that these were the words of the Buddha? Because what happened was during this is what's called the First Council, when they got all his disciples together, Ananda, his attendant, would say, "Thus I had heard during this time, this place, this is what the Buddha said," and everyone in that council who were also enlightened, they would say, "Yes, I agree," and that became a particular canon. And so it took about 7 months for all this to come together, and like Rina said, these suttas were remembered and they were chanted, and the way they used to commit things to memory was through chanting. And you might think, well, if it's in someone's memory, is this really, how do we know it hasn't been modified or changed over the years? Well, if you actually think about it, maybe if someone wrote it down, there's a historical record, but at the same time, if everyone remembered the same thing and everyone had to chant it together, if one person got a particular word wrong or tried to change it, it would be very hard.
Yes, imagine trying to go to the concert and you were the only one who sing the wrong tune.
Yeah, that's right, exactly. And so each one of these teachings got put down into various suttas. And what has been passed down over the years is called the Pali Canon, and it's been composed of what is known as the Tipitaka, which are the three baskets. And they contain first the Vinaya, which are the rules for the monastics, the Sutta Pitaka, which are the main discourses that the Buddha gave. Yeah. And this is where we find a lot of his teachings. And there are 5 books within that. And also the Abhidharma, which are some of the more higher teachings, or the more metaphysical teachings as well.
Mm.
So,
can I ask at what point that these sutra has been grouped into books? Because before, it's everything is in term of memorized and oral. So since when it's become grouped into different books?
So, I believe first was the Vinaya, and then they put together Sutta Pitaka. But then when it was committed to actual writing, this was about the 4th council in the first or so century AD.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. So in terms of the historical side of it, we understand this, the Pali Canon, as more closer to what the Buddha actually taught, because what happened was during the Second Council, so after the First Council, they put this together, and then after about 100 years later, there was another council. Yeah.
Was it more than that?
So the second council was about 100 years, and then what happened was there was a group of more senior or elder monastics who there was some dispute over the some monastic discipline, some of the rules about monastics. and this particular elder group split off from the main group, and they are essentially what would be, this particular school is essentially what is now the forefathers of the Theravadan school. And there were about 18 Buddhist schools at that time, and most of them have disappeared into history. And so what we see represented as Buddhism today has various aspects of these particular schools, but what we see as Theravada Buddhism comes from this second council around about 100 years after the Buddha's passing. And I guess what the Tipitaka, these particular three baskets are also within the teachings of the Mahayana school. So in a way, Theravada, the word Theravada is the doctrine of the elders because of the split from the elders, but sometimes it's referred to as Hinayana, which is the smaller vehicle by the Mahayana, which is the greater vehicle. But you could also see that because they have a smaller collection of suttas, and the Mahayana also have more suttas than the Theravada. But I won't bore you with the details anyway. But if you're interested, there's much more you can read about this. Yes.
I don't mind interrupting.
Yes.
Just with like how it was sort of memorized over time. I don't know. I remember one of these monastics called Bhante Sujato just saying that it's incredible just how accurate, because oral tradition can actually be, because they're so committed to memorizing the words and they chant it and stuff, so it's actually not necessarily less accurate than the written tradition.
Exactly. Yeah.
And also, maybe worth mentioning, Abhidhamma refers to commentaries, right?
Yeah. So because the Abhidhamma is not recognized by the Mahayana, they see it as a later edition.
Yeah.
But I mean, you could go into all these scholarly disputes and history, but you just get the general idea. But normally, if you, I have some resources at the end if you want to read the suttas or know where to start. But the suttas are a very good place to go to if you want to understand the teachings of the Buddha in the words which were understood closer to the Buddha's time, I suppose. So there's no way I can go through the main teachings of Theravada Buddhism in a few minutes, but just as a general overview.
So you want to explain about how this come about? Like the main teachings, if you're going back, this is the record from when the Buddha's, during the Buddha life, and when he encounters someone and gives some teaching and helping them, he would particular choose to give different teaching to different particular people on different topic based on their temperament, what is their hindrances and their wisdoms. For example, if he run into someone who really have attachment to fire worship, he will start giving the teaching based on around the thing that they have interest, and then after that, when there's a right time, he will deliver the Dhamma to open up and so they can see the truth. But what occurring, the main teaching we're talking about, the teaching that he keep bringing up in many different occasions. So, and eventually that's how it was collected, right? Like put together, but actually it's come from many occasions of time when the Buddha encountered different kind of groups of people giving the teaching on different occasions.
So we tend to know that these are definitely the core teachings of of the Buddha, because these particular aspects were repeated in many of these suttas that he gave. And you find that within the suttas there is a lot of repetition as well, which makes it more conducive to be remembered. And also we know which parts of the sutta that the Buddha wanted to emphasize. Yeah. And so the Theravadan school focuses on the very core teachings that the Buddha taught. And these are also agreed upon by the Mahayana school as well. There is no dispute about that. And the core teaching of the Buddha is, of course, the Four Noble Truths, which is recognizing and acknowledging that all beings experience suffering. And in order to overcome suffering or transcend suffering, we need to really understand the cause of suffering. And to do that, we really need to look deeply and also follow the Noble Eightfold Path, which he set out to guide us into developing wisdom to see. Yeah. And the Noble Eightfold Path is a practice of developing moral conduct, complemented by mental cultivation or meditation, and also developing wisdom as well. And developing wisdom to see what we would call the three characteristics of existence, which is seeing and understanding the impermanent nature of all conditioned things, the lack of a permanent self, and also understanding suffering. So once we truly understand this, we're able to let go and transcend suffering. And the goal of this, which is the third noble truth, is really to attain nibbana by becoming enlightened or an arahant. And the Mahayana, as I said, also recognize the same teachings, but they have just a very slightly definition of what full enlightenment is. So whereas in Theravada Buddhism the goal is to become an arahant, the goal in Mahayana is to become fully enlightened by becoming a Buddha, just like the Buddha was. And they feel that this is such an important goal that they're willing to not become enlightened until all other sentient beings become enlightened first. And to do that, they take a vow to become a bodhisattva, which is to help all sentient beings.
So what is the term bodhisattva mean?
A being to help all beings.
So the bodhisattva is a term that also been used in Theravada as well. If you read a lot of books and sutras, there will be term that used for the moment that the Buddha is still cultivating the parami, the perfection, in order to become the Buddha. But once the bodhisattva become the Buddha, then the term will change.
How's the term changed?
The term changed will be the enlightened one, or the Buddha, or the Katakata. But you know how we always describe when Prince Siddhartha, he go out from the palace, leave his family behind, and search for the truth, until to the point where he sit under the Bodhi tree, he's still Bodhisattva. And then after that, then he become the Buddha.
It has a different meaning in the two traditions.
Yeah, that's right.
So there's two different meanings.
So
that's why I asked to clarify in terms of bodhisattva. Even arahant has different meanings in the two traditions.
That's correct. Yes. So it's not quite equivalent.
Mm.
but it's recognized, a bodhisattva is recognized Theravada as the Buddha before he was the Buddha as well. Yeah. And also the three characteristics is recognized in the Mahayana, but they also have emptiness as well, which is which is, I guess, an
sunyata.
Yeah, sunyata, which we won't go into today.
There are some gray area too, because some Theravadin teacher also incorporate sunyata or emptiness into their teachings too.
I'm sure we'll leave it to the capable hands of Jim Chio next week to talk about the core teachings, which will take more than the whole session. So, what's going on here, Reena?
Oh, I took this photo from the Buddhist Society of UK Pilgrimage in Thailand. So, it just to represent, this is a sample daily life of locals in Theravadin culture in Thailand and a monk. So, basically, this is the activity is called alms rounds, and it happened in the morning, early in the morning. So monks or monastics, they don't work, and they, especially in Theravada, they don't cook, they don't collect and keep food. So alms round is just a way to for them to, you know, maintain the necessity in their life by receiving food and also giving opportunity for other people to develop generosity and develop the merit. So people would wake up early in the morning and offering the food to the monastic first thing before they even eat, and that's regarded as a very good start of the day by the act of generosity.
Next slide.
So now we were talking about organization structure in Theravadin Buddhism. So there are fourfold, and what are they?
So Fourfold Sangha, which the Buddha laid out, was the monastic men, the monks, the monastic women, the nuns, and also the lay men and the lay women.
And then on this page, we will be talking about the monks and the nuns, which is called, the Pali term is bhikkhu, bhikkhuni, and also have the samanera and samaneri, which different culture now refer to different titles. But in the Buddha time, I believe that samaneras and samaneri refer to junior people who decide to go forth. So anyone who is under 20 years old, then when they enter, then they become samanera if they are a boy or male, and then a female samaneri. But nowadays, some places, say in Thailand, you will become samanera when you, anytime until you're 25, and if you keep ordaining, then you just you will progress into bhikkhu or monk. Why in Western, like in Australia, I think like especially the female monastics, they will enter no matter what age, they would enter in terms of become a junior nun or seminary first, and when they feel that they're more confident, they will take into another level of ordination and become bhikkhuni, become a fully ordained nun.
And only when the senior monastic recognizes that they're ready to take on their give it like an internship or like a trial period.
And I think it is that was a good progress, and not like that's a way to warm them up a bit. For example, the precepts or rules of the junior nuns and monks or samanera and seminary are just only 10, why the one for the fully ordained for monks are 227 rules and 331 rules for female? And so so there are quite a lot of rules there, but these rules are not being set from the first. The Buddha is not just wake up at one day and like, oh, let's make all these 227 rules and then can remember, so they like they don't have enough to remember. No, but what happened is when at first Sangha just grow organically, no rules, everyone enlightened, everyone happy, know where they are. But once they have more people, more trouble. And so, and then you got a lot of people who have creative way of cause troubles, and then there will be also someone that make sure to go and report to the Buddha, and the Buddha will like, you shouldn't do that. Okay, we have one rule. So from 1 into 3, 4, 5, and 227.
Mm.
So that means the people in 2,500 years ago are not much more well behaved than us.
Yes.
Why are there more rules for women than men?
So I knew this question would come up.
I know.
Yeah. So back in the day, 2,500 years ago, India and the world was a very different place. And it was much more inconvenient for women to do many things. So there are actually more rules for women in a sense that to protect them from having to do a lot more things that women are generally responsible for. Like, for example, cooking was expected for serving men, etc. So there was extra rules to protect them. For example, appearing.
From not doing that, you might want to.
That, yeah, exactly. Protect them from.
But isn't that also a rule?
That's
that
correct as well.
Also
yeah.
Sorry, I didn't get you.
And just like responsibilities, but also like if you're out in a, if you're outside and having more than one person, more than one bhikkhuni around, while you're, whereas with a, if you have, it's better to have more females around in a group if you're out.
So that's one of the rules.
That's
right.
One of the rules.
And also
yeah.
One thing is women equality not exist
that's
back
right.
then. So some rules is there to, so to make peace with all the male that fool with testosterone. For example, the woman would have to, no matter how long they have ordained, they have to have respect for what? Bhikkhu or monks?
Can I just say that is a controversial point actually. I know
yes.
that it's part of the Thai tradition, but there's certainly scholars and other like senior monastics who say that what you call in the Garudama rules were actually created later. They weren't actually original teaching of Buddhism.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
But that hasn't been be able to distinguish definite. So in general,
there's
that's
a lot of, and that was created specifically for one, like high class lady for whom, you know, she might have had humility issues, but that was for that person in particular. Whereas there were nuns that were ordained before the Buddha's mum was ordained. This is the person we're referring to. And that those nuns didn't have the Garudama rules. So there, it is. Sorry, I just want to say that it is a controversial point, and it's not necessarily
true
or widely accepted.
But at this point, it's not proven to be not true.
Some
definitely
people
yet.
Feel it is. Some people feel it isn't.
Yes.
Yeah, so it's controversial. It's debated. Yeah.
So there's still a lot of work or discussions, scholarly understanding of where these rules were derived from,
mm-hmm.
but this is what has been recorded, I guess, in the Vinaya as we understand it
and
today.
And there's not all rules that make sense nowadays.
Yeah.
For example, the monk cannot accept the black goat skin.
Mm.
Black
goat skin.
Makes
the
sense.
Skin of a black goat, for
mm.
example, which doesn't make
I
sense.
Imagine Vontae Jason accepting that.
Yeah.
And walking around.
So the Buddha actually said at just before he passed away to Ananda that you can just let go of the smaller rules
and just keep to the more, most important rules. And it said in the story that Ananda was so distressed that he actually didn't ask the Buddha what rules he should be keeping and which rules he was letting go. And so now we will never know. That's how the story goes. But some monastics are more, keep to the rules much more stricter than others. It really depends on the monastic, the tradition, how it's understood, how these rules are understood as well. Mm.
Mm. So some different rules are, for example, listening to music or even singing.
That's right, and entertainment.
Yeah, but I think in Vajrayana, they can perform.
That's
they
right.
They can sing.
So the Mahayana also have a different understanding of what these rules are as well.
Sorry.
Yes.
So celibacy is something they have to obey. They have to, but
that's
handling
correct.
Your money is forbidden. So the second and third, and the parents, are they forbidden to do those things?
That's correct.
But celibacy is they have to obey.
Oh yeah, sorry, confusing.
Yeah, because the first one is they have to stick to.
Yeah,
they
okay.
were forbidden to do.
So it should be. They should be celibate, I suppose.
Yeah.
I guess you understand.
Yeah.
This was my last night, just trying to put some slides together.
That's okay.
Yeah, that's correct. And I guess what is the rule that is mostly observed by all Theravada is eating before noon. And Theravada monks are not necessarily vegetarian because they are supposed to eat what is offered to them, rather than being too picky about it. But it's they should be eating two meals a day, ideally. Bhante Jason eats one meal a day.
I don't think there's not necessary have anything say in the
that's
sutra
right.
about
yeah, exactly.
two
no,
meals.
The suttas actually say specifically only eat one meal a day.
One meal a day,
mm.
yes.
Mm-hmm.
But most modern Theravadan monastics today eat two. So
totally
it really
depends.
It depends.
Totally depends.
Yes.
Totally depends. These are all minors.
Yeah.
And
that's right.
What the Buddhas set out in terms of living monastic life is that they reduce the worldly responsibility, reducing the attachment to the world, and living simply, and responsible in terms of you know, basic care to the body so that they can continue practice and develop the wisdoms.
Mm.
So that's why they have very little processions, especially in the old days, with just only three pieces of robes, one bowl so they can have containers to put food. Because imagine if you wandering around back then, there's not much disposable cup and forks and spoons, and then, you know, needle and razors. And just things for, you know, fixing their robes and shaving. So you require a little back then, not even need to have, you know, chewy, because everyone walked barefoot.
Mm.
And then they encourage to wander homelessly in order to, you know, practice and also spread, giving, sharing the Dharma to people. And I think because of that practice of homelessness, that's why Buddhism also spreads through many, many areas, many regions.
Mm.
It's also an exchange of if the monks receive generosities through being given the meals, offer some medicines or invite to the house, then they shall giving the teachings. And if these monastics not behave properly under the rules and conduct, then, you know, people don't want to support them. And so some kind of activities and offerings that people like to offer to monastics. And because they don't, you know, many monastics don't carry money, then they don't need much. So most of the things is what they're offering, garland, flowers, as a something as represent purity. Just like the and also robes, especially after the end of the rain retreat, which Justin will mention. They will have a robe offering ceremony as well, which in the old days, the Buddhist time, then it will be the act of, you know, the monks go and gathering rags and then seal them, stitching them together to make robes, and then they would decide which monks in the community that need robes, and then they will like, okay, you can have it. It's an act of, you know, working together in harmony.
Yeah. So there's the role of the monastics, but also the role of the lay people, which is really to support the monastic community, but also practice under their guidance as well.
Mm-hmm. Yes.
Some of the things that the lay people commit to is taking refuge in the Buddha, the Dharma, and the Sangha, the Triple Gem, which is the Buddha himself, his teachings, and also taking refuge in the community of the monastics. This is something also practiced in Mahayana tradition as well.
I must add that in the old day, when you're taking refuge, there is nothing more than simply request this to the Buddha or to the monastic, the enlightened one. I would like to take in the refuge. And when people back then, when they say, they really mean it. Right? So it's like taking an oath to follow the path and practice. And so the Sangha, the monastics, when you read in the sutra, is actually mostly made the monastic who have gained a certain level of wisdom. So in that one, if you're explaining it, at least that means they have to have some progress in practice and gain some wisdom, at least become a stream enter, and then up to the level of become an enlightened one. So because they have walked the path, they understand the teaching, they have practiced, that's why we should respect them. It doesn't have, Sangha doesn't have to be monastic, actually, I'm sorry.
Yeah.
Sangha in this meaning can also mean lay people who have that wisdom and have the breakthrough, at least become the stream entry until they become
noble ones. Yeah, so yeah, the definition of Sangha has sort of shifted around over these years, but this was the original definition.
And also what important is, you know, living the life that not harmful to other and also not harmful to self, and that's why it's a basic obligations, even though not compulsory, for all the lay people to follow five precepts. Have five precepts been explained during the last sessions? So these are basically, the five precepts in general is just refrain from any activity that will harm yourself, harm other people, and then will cause yourself, as, you know, endowment and situation where you would not be able to cultivate, you know, mental and wisdom development.
Yeah.
Maybe list them. What are the five?
Yeah. So, for example, think of what you can do to harm other people and yourself. To kill, to taking other people's life, one's life, taking one's belongings, what is not given, to having false speech, and then all the other harmful speech, harsh speech,
gossiping, lying,
and then conducting adultery, and then the last one is indulge yourself in intoxications.
Mm.
Not just adultery, but other sexual misconduct as well. Can I make one comment about that? Like, it's just for the new people. It's not quite like the Ten Commandments.
That's right.
You
can think of it as training rules.
Yeah.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. So rather than thou shalt not, it's refraining from On special occasions, lay people also take 8 or 10 precepts, especially if you go on retreat, just like the seminaries as well. Yeah.
And then they also, since they are here supporting Buddhism as a community, then they do what they can where the monastic they need help in terms of, you know, offering them food, any basic requisites, and then also, you know, encourage their, in all day, encourage their children and their family to ordain. And so that's the saying in Thailand, not my generation, but before, that if you're gonna give your daughters to some young man, you have, if that young man haven't ordained before, it's unlikely that the parents will, you know, allow the marriage happen.
They're not considered ripe. It's like a rite of passage almost, temporary ordination. So yes, temporary ordination happens today in Thailand and Myanmar, but not so much in Sri Lanka as well. Yeah, so like we were saying before, the lay people offer robes and requisites and any way to help the temple. And they see this as making of merit, like having a good intention to help support something that is good and wholesome. And it's kind of evolved over the years, this idea of making merit as well. But we see that a lot of this generosity of the lay community has helped build a lot of temples in the past. And there's also been a lot of cultural influences in this as well. But that's a basic idea.
Mm. And in the same time, some people might actually start being with just being born Buddhist and have faith based from, I'm talking about, you know, people in Southeast Asia and maybe other, they have faith and they're doing offerings, but the act of they going to the place like temples, monastery to offer, give them opportunity to have a chance to listen to a Dharma, the teaching, should they not go there and staying at home, they would not get access to all these, you know, wisdoms. And in the same time, the monastics in many, many years, especially to where I was born in Thailand, the monastic actually also integrate to the community from the start. When the child in the village born, they would go and give some blessings. And when they go to school and naming the children, and when they're ill, they also monks practice herbal medicines and giving them some medicines to help. But in a little bit of that, there will always chance and opportunity for monastic to giving the teaching into everything, even from the birth, what kind of practice as a parent they should be doing when they're sick, what kind of thing they should be doing, and when up until the day they die and have cremations. So it's not only the Dharma, it's not only stay in the monastery. Most of the time, the Buddhism, which many, many hundred, almost thousand years, integrate in daily life, and it's kind of like a part integrate into the daily life of people.
Right.
Unlike nowadays, it's more like it's go to the school, the school give the teaching, and you go out and that's it. If you want to experience more Buddhist, real or not, you just go to temple.
It used to be that the kids go to school. The monks are the teachers. Like schooling was done in the monasteries.
Yeah.
Until colonialism took over in like Sri Lanka and other places.
Yeah. For example, in Thailand, we have a lot of. If you go to Thailand and you're reading names of school, there's a lot of school with the word "wat." So it means this school is a part of temple, and the temple give education. What happened in the old day to be able to read and write, children would be sent to temple to serve the monastics, gradually cleaning and following in the arm rounds. And in return, the monks would become teachers, teaching them how to learn, how to read, how to conduct. But this changed because during the time that the colonialists, in order to remain in Thailand at least free, they would do some negotiation and have to change the educational system to be more westernized. And with that westernized, that's they remove the connection from Buddhism and the school to the society to be more like organizations, everything based from government and all that.
So during the year, the monastics spent some time in retreat, and this period is called the Vasa, and it came from when the Buddha was in India. There's a period of time, like a monsoon season, where it was very hard to travel because the Buddha would travel normally with his monks on foot, but during the season there'll be a lot of flooding, it'll be very difficult to travel, so a supporter might offer their place for the monks to stay during the Vasa. And this tradition is still kept today.
Mm-hmm.
And at the end of the Vasa, there is an offering of robes as well.
Mm-hmm. Let's go.
Yep.
this is me during the so this is one of the important building in the monastery in Thailand, and most of them is called Uposop or the ordination hall. And then the intricate of art is because a lot of people in the past they devote their work energy into the thing that they think is the most important, which is the supporting of Buddhism, the religions. And I can say it's also because there's a sima, which is the mark of the area that can allow creating the area where the ordination can happen inside. And then just quickly go through a few terminology with image. So there are some mythology creatures in Buddhism, and different traditions might have different depictions. For example, the great serpents or naga, which is also occurring, being mentioned a lot in the Buddha's sutra.
Mm, stories.
So that's the one depiction of the nagas. And then a stupa is a place where holding important relics, and so most of the time will be the Buddha's relics or the
some great masters.
And
this was very important for Buddhism to spread because if the monastic had some relics, then and they could travel with those relics. They could erect a stupa somewhere, and this could become a center of learning and where people come to pay homage as well.
Mm. And then they was as a also occurring a lot in the Buddha stories in the old day as well.
That's right. So if you sort of see these iconography around,
yes.
These are very prominent in Theravada Buddhism.
But there will be different costume of the devas. If we have aborigines deva, that probably look different. And this one, I think from the way I look, it must be Burmese style.
Mm.
In the Thai deva style, there's less clothes because it's hot.
It's hot in Burma as well.
I don't know why, they're just so dressed up.
I thought I would just briefly mention about women monasticism in Theravada Buddhism, because up till recently, actually, when the Buddha had the fourfold sangha, there were...
What's the fourfold sangha?
The lay men, lay women, monastic women and monastic men. There were ordained bhikkhunis. But over the years, along the time, this lineage of bhikkhunis,
which are monastic women.
Yes, monastic women had died out. There has been, in modern times, a movement to revive the bhikkhuni order, and it has come about with some prominent monastics, such as Bhikkhuni Dhananda, who is seen there, and also Ajahn Brahm has also created a movement. But this is, a bit of an issue that has a lot of conversation in modern times, and some very traditional Buddhists may not recognize this, but this is something that's also been happening as well.
Maybe it died out in Thailand, but it certainly was still always active in places like Taiwan, where they're mostly female monastics, and even in Sri Lanka, there's been monastics for quite a while.
Yeah, so
Fire organization.
That's right. Yeah. So in the Mahayana tradition, bhikkhunis or female monastics is still a very strong tradition. That's
right. You want to mention about different roles like white Meshi?
Yeah, so in Burma and Thailand, because there has not been, until recently, has not been a very big tradition of bhikkhuni ordination, women can ordain as Meshi, which is, they don't have as many rules as a fully ordained monk. So they wear the different colour of robes. For example, in Burma, it's pink. And in Thailand, it's brown.
White.
Okay.
Sometimes brown.
Yeah.
And for example, this Ajahn, she's from Amaravati in England. And even though she wears brown, but she's actually not seminary or fully ordained.
So, what are some teachers in the Theravadan tradition? There's many, and we can talk about all night. Yeah,
but these are notable ones.
These are some
from
of the famous
wheel of Western.
That's right. So, some you may have heard of is Ajahn Brahm, of course.
Nice.
He's in Perth, who loves to tell a lot of jokes. But his very well known teacher is Ajahn Chah, from the Thai forest tradition, and one of...
Maybe if you can tell everybody which picture is who.
Yeah.
Yes, so from the first one is Ajahn Chah. He's he just passed away about less than 20 years.
1992. 25 years.
Yes, 25 years.
So
and I was
he's the fellow on the top left?
Yes, on the top left, Ajahn Chah. And if you're tracing the lineage, and then he's a student of one of the students of Ajahn Mun, who is also a very notable Thai forest monk. And Ajahn Mun have lots of students, but Ajahn Chah have a lot of Western international students, and therefore he is one of the most famous monastics in the world, because many of his students then went to set up a new, you know, monastery and organizations in different countries, including Ajahn Brahm as well.
Mm.
And the one on the right hand, after Ajahn Chah.
So one of his most senior Western disciples is Ajahn Sumedho, who is an American monk. He's the next one after Ajahn Chah. And very well recognized in the West, and of course after that is Ajahn Brahm, who is currently has a monastery in Perth as well. And to the far right at the top, that's left, right to you guys, is Venerable Dhammananda, who is a very well-respected Sri Lankan teacher. And then on the bottom left is Mahasi Sayadaw, and he is very well known for the teaching of the Vipassana practice. Yes. and also another very well-known teacher of the Vipassana meditation practice is S.N. Goenka, who had passed away very recently as well. And they have many schools around the world teaching Vipassana meditation. And the roots of this movement that has become well known came from Burma. Yes, even though the Buddha did teach a lot about Vipassana as well. And the lady on the I think that's your right, is Ayakema, and she is one of the first Western female monastics. And she wrote a book called Being No One, Going Nowhere. Yes. And she also founded Wat Buddha Dharma, which is in Wiseman's Ferry as well. So just reassuring, some of the schools of Theravadan Buddhism that you might have heard of in modern times is, of course, the Vipassana school, and Goenka and Mahasi are two types of those schools. And also, Vipassana emphasizes insight practice, whereas another school has a focus more on the calm abiding practice. For example, the Pa Ak school in Burma as well. So, just very, very briefly, at a very high level, the Buddha didn't necessarily try very hard to differentiate, you need to do this more, do that more. These are actually complementary practices. So it's very important to have both calm as well as insight. And these particular schools just emphasize and support these type of practices more because they feel that it's very good for cultivating certain qualities and understanding. But as you learn about Buddhism, you'd come to explore what works best for you as well. And the Thai forest tradition from Ajahn Chah and Brahm Ajahn Sumedho. So, there's a lot of Theravadan monasteries around us. When we started writing, what centers can we think of? We just kept writing.
Yes.
There's more and more.
2 a.m.
That's right.
I have to say, Alok is pretty mixed.
Yes, that's right. Ajahn Veeramol Mahinda is very supportive of other traditions in Buddhism as well. So if you want to actually learn more about Theravadan Buddhism and read the suttas, if you haven't read many suttas, a good place to start is the Dhammapada, which has many very insightful and beautiful sayings from the Buddha. That's right, very short verses. But if you want to actually read some of the suttas, especially on specific topics, a good one to start would be the Kariyana Metta Sutta, where the Buddha teaches about loving kindness and also mindfulness, the Satipatthana Sutta. You'd be able to get many books that talk about these sutras as well. And also these websites. Access Insight is a very invaluable resource if you want to actually read the suttas. Many of those translations are by Venerable Tanisaro. And Sutta Central is a website that's been set up by Bhante Sujata.
Venerable
Tani.
Buddha Net.
Yes.
Sutta Central and Access, can I give a little ad?
Do a plug.
They're incredible. Bhante Sujata is a Western Buddhist monk who's also an incredible scholar that looks into early Buddhism, and he's trying to translate a lot of the early suttas into English, and it's a really engaging and accessible website where you can find all the suttas in a number of different languages, both from the sort of Theravada, but also from some sort of Chinese and other sources as well. It's fantastic, and access to insight is also they're just really high quality information on sort of the early Buddhist teachings and Buddhist suttas and stuff. Those two websites, highly recommend them.
Talk about Buddha net?
Oh, once upon a time, there was this monk who practiced Burmese tradition, and he's really cool. And he made this website when we still in kindergarten or something.
Yeah.
And he just sort of setting everything, and then just put everything. So he's really cool.
Yeah, he learned to code himself. Back in the day when the internet was just starting up, and he said, we need a resource for Buddhists. And so he just made a website on his own with not a lot of help, really.
Mm-hmm.
And now it's become almost a global source of information for Buddhism. So
yeah.
Please visit.
It's
Buddha.
An app for that, of course, as well. You can go to on your phone for BuddhaNet.
His name is Venerable Panyavara.
Yes.
Is that a question?
And
oh, no,
it's
not.
Oh, sorry,
that's
like there is an app.
Oh,
okay.
Yeah.
And he's
oh, wow.
spending a lot of his time
yeah.
on the this 70-acre monastery in Lismore.
Mm.
Restore the forest, lawn the lawn, and then running like Vipassana teaching.
That's right.
Mm.
So visit Bodhi Tree Monastery if you ever get the chance.
And also he's in the He's still developing this WhatsApp there.
Still getting funds.
Yeah, still need some more funding in terms of developing Vipassana retreat center.
Yeah.
Yes.
Nice.
Yeah.
Did you do it?
No. He got a graphic designer son.
Yeah. Right.
Okay, any question?
Yes.
Is there any formal regulation for women bhikkhuni in Theravada countries?
Sure.
Formal recognition?
Yes, for the women bhikkhuni.
When you're talking about formal, you're talking about which country?
All Theravada countries. Thailand, Burma.
It's mixed.
Yeah.
And, sorry. No.
Maybe you can give about, what about Sri Lankan's point of view?
There's a lot of nuns in Sri Lanka. To be honest, I'm not sure as to the level of respect they receive compared to the males. I can't give you an accurate answer to that, but I think they're reasonably well respected. Like even in like traditional villages, you do get like a matriarchal nun sort of thing. It's not, something unheard of. So there's a lot of respect, but
they're not bhikkhunis, though.
That's true.
You get to see all the markets.
Okay,
yeah.
Sure.
Yeah.
But it, certainly Ajahn Brahm ordained a group of nuns from Mongo who are considered to be the same level. But I think really, Bhante Jason, maybe you can make some comments.
Formal recognition in the Theravadan world. I don't think in the Theravadan world there is formal recognition for bhikkhuni ordination in the traditional countries. So none in Burma, not in Sri Lanka, not in Thailand.
No bhikkhunis in Sri Lanka,
There are bhikkhunis.
I mean, they're
travelling
through,
not...
but I wouldn't say that the mainstream organisations approve of bhikkhuni ordination.
Wow.
Nor would I say that the mainstream organisations in Thailand and Burma or Laos give formal recognition. The only people who would give formal recognition would be Ajahn Brahm's village in Australia.
Yeah. There were two bhikkhuni ordinations done in Sri Lanka, I think 96, but it's not, so they did revive the ordination bit. It's not not all Buddhist organizations, especially the very conservative ones, recognize that. Because there were monastics, but also the two Korean nuns came to help. Even though very senior male monastics were there, it wasn't always recognized. But I think society is changing slowly. It does take time. Same with the female ordinations in Thailand as well. Venerable Dhammananda's monastery, she says that the local community are very supportive, but of course there are conservative elements within Thailand that don't recognize this as well. And in Burma, I've heard terrible stories about nuns being arrested, but it will take time as well. Yeah,
and to explain this is when you say formal, it have to have authority, and different country have different authoritative organizations. Even in Thailand, you know, there are two main school inside Theravada, which is the Thammayut and Mahanikaya, and they have also different authority too. So, and in Burma or in Laos, they have their own patriarchy and the system as well. So it doesn't have anything like United Nations of Buddhism in terms of global.
Yeah. There's no Pope.
Yeah,
no
Pope.
Which is probably a good thing.
Yes.
So that the 331 rules, that was for women. Was that the more for bhikkhunis at the very beginning? If that, you know, for the female monastics, if that was the case, does that mean at the very beginning Buddha actually ordained women?
Yeah, so that's correct. The Buddha ordained women at the day, but there were some stories that went at the time.
There's a lot of versions.
That's right. Yes.
There's a lot of versions of how the bhikkhuni become.
Some of the like for early nuns like Buddha, like her ordination was a Buddha saying, "Come, Buddha." That was it. You know, it's not nothing, no complex rules, anything. She just automatically a nun, and then she came in line, and it was just about the practice.
Mm-hmm.
But yeah, interesting.
Also, one easy way to think about the 331 rules is to just not take them too seriously, because the transmission for the bhikkhuni rules is much less reliable. So we really don't know how many rules are actually there right at the start and during the Buddha's time, and how much rule were added later. It's very, very uncertain.
Okay, but there are 331 rules.
Well, inside the current Theravadin version of the bhikkhuni rules.
Oh.
Right, but texts change over a long period of time. And we really don't know, particularly in relation to the bhikkhuni rules, how much things have changed. I mean, there's a lot of evidence that things have changed, and it's such a mess, actually, that we don't know anything.
So the rules are there, but they don't have anyone to follow it. They don't, I mean, if they don't really...
It was a dead text. Dead text for a long time.
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah.
And
tradition to live out.
And there's no... Because there wasn't a living tradition, it's very hard them to see what works and what doesn't, and interpretations, etc. So,
and those rules, some of them are not applicable to the current, modern world. But mostly the rules that a good teacher will encourage students or monastics to do is the rules that will make sure that they to help to be able to reflect themselves internally. So whenever there is the, you know, the conditions of the impermanent, or the condition of the sufferings, or the condition of non-self coming up, that rule will keep you intact before going and letting, you know, your desires or your aversion go and doing things. So, for example, if the rules that to forbid you having meal before noon, for example, if we are lay people, when we're hungry, when we're seeing something, let's say I want to have bubble tea. By the time, if you are monastic, you will not be, well, bubble tea, let's say hamburger. So say I want to have hamburger. If you are lay people, you can actually go in and you just follow your hunger. Or even sometimes you're not even hungry, but you're seeing, you know, ice cream, heart coming on, you have that desire coming up. But when you have this rule, you can't. You just have to actually face off, you know, your defilement, your craving straight away. So those rules, in a way, it can help the monastics be able to contemplate on the condition of the world easier. I hope that answered the question.
Any other questions, comments?
Anyone feel like ice cream or hamburger now?
Yes.
You're really hungry. It's just something I didn't know before, but I think one of the, you mentioned too, so if in Theravadan tradition, the basically someone get enlightened, then they won't come back again. But for Mahayana, in Mahayana tradition, they will keep coming back to, then the main purpose to help people who are still suffering.
So I don't know if maybe it's a bit confusing, but Mahayana, their goal, or their practice actually, is to develop the paramis. So they develop certain qualities that allow them to be able to develop themselves well, but also to have compassion, to practice compassion, to help sentient beings. And they've made a very strong vow to be able to help sentient beings. And I'm sure Jonathan would be able to talk about that better in the Mahayana session. But the goal is slightly different. In the Mahayana tradition, they aspire to become a bodhisattva. Yeah. And that's so that they can aspire, they can be able to help other beings reach Buddhahood as well. And the vow is so strong that they say, I won't become enlightened until all other beings can. Yeah. And I guess it takes, as you know, being a Buddha is a very rare event. So to aspire to one day become a Buddha is, I guess, a very long view of things in terms of as a goal. Yeah. Mm.
And it's not that everyone can reach that.
That's
because
right.
There's a lot of difficult and challenging work to go away, to go along. So many people who know maybe in, and then we all believe in rebirth. So the Theravada belief is that if you want to practice, become the next Buddha, there's a lot of work to do, but you can always change the way and back off up until the point that that person will run into a Buddha and the Buddha make endorsement. Oh,
yeah.
This person will become a Buddha and some things. So, you know, all you have to do if you want to become Bodhisattva is you know, make a vow, make determination, and doing a gaigani, make a merit, and wait until another kasillion years, seeing a Buddha, the Buddha make predictions, and then another many kasillion or kasillion years, then you become a Buddha. But so often along the way, you see how the distance of some people might change their mind and decide to enlighten, that some person might run into the Buddha. There's a story that there's a few people who cultivate to become, wanted to become one of the Buddha, but upon going, seeing the Buddha, or learning about Buddhism, they just change their mind and decide to get enlightened. So it's not a wasteful path, because either way, there will be a lot of chance for you to accumulate merit, helping others, helping yourself, or helping yourself.
Yeah. I don't know if that helps.
We'll probably explore more about the Bodhisattva
and yeah.
the Tibetan Lion
mm-hmm.
traditions.
Yeah.
Yeah.
One of Ajahn Mun's students, Ajahn Mun is a teacher of Ajahn Chah,
mm-hmm.
is Wong Pu Dun, and he is a very powerful monk. And this is inside Thai story, like among Thai people, that because he has been cultivating and practicing to be a Bodhisattva, to be a Buddha, so many years. But he let go the determinations. But with that, he's still very powerful, so he can, he have a lot of strength in
mm.
terms of meditation, and up to the point that, and I can't verify this, close to the point that he can actually see what practice is best for him, for individual people. So for example, one monk might come and he will say, you have to go and do in the contemplation on the body. Another monk come will have to do contemplation on vedana. And if they don't go and follow his practice, their practice will not progress very well. There was one time there's a monk came, and with other, he will see one person, close his eyes, maybe close his eye for 15 minutes, half an hour. And then when he opened up, he say a few words, and that's it. You don't get any much instruction. Take it or leave it. And there was one time there's a monk who traveled quite far, came to receive his guidance. He closed his eyes, meditated for many minutes, and then he opened up. He just said, you have to, your kamatana or your focus on meditation is a single strand of hair. And that monk was super sad and upset because he traveled quite far. Why I don't get to do many other more fancy kamatana with just one hair? So what happened, he went back and he tried all many other meditation and teaching and training, but he didn't have any progress until one day he kind of like, oh, just let's try this. And then he progressed straight away. I don't have much more detail, but just some story fun to share with it. And the quality of being able to discern which practice good for which people, originally supposed to be only for someone as powerful as the Buddha. Mm.
Mm. Yeah, so I guess this is a very introductory overview, but I guess the best way to know what works for you is really to explore more and try the practices. Listen to different teachers and see what resonates.
Mm-hmm.
That's the most important thing, because unlike other religions, or maybe I shouldn't compare, but Buddhism's not so. There are scriptures and there are texts, but they're very important to refer to those texts. But it's also very important experiential. Religion, so you need to practice it, and you have to experience it for yourself in order to realize what the Buddha is teaching. So the best thing is to practice and see what resonates with you, what works, and what is useful and what isn't. Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
Yes.
Just when I first came to Buddhism, I noticed the first thing. That's really helped me, just for the benefit of the new people maybe. Would you be able to repeat the Four Noble Truths?
You've got 5 minutes.
I don't know, just say it. And
I love
then, because I found at the very beginning, when I had some difficulties, because the first thing that actually drew me to Buddhism, to study Buddhism, was the Four Noble Truths, just four sentences. And I found, okay, this could be the path. I don't know, just a suggestion, it could help if...
I can feel it. Can I help if I can?
You can.
Okay. Well, there was one time, I give you the answer through a story. Yeah. So there was once the king of Dusita, Heavenly Realm, what is his name?
I don't know what story you want to tell.
Yeah. Yeah, just say there was a Supadeva. He's a head of the one of the level in the heaven. He went down to see the Buddha and he asked, can you sum up for me what is the essence of Buddhist teaching? And it translates into English that there is nothing to be cling to. There is absolutely nothing to be attached or to be clinged to. And I think that sums up the whole thing of the Four Noble Truths. So we suffer. The first one is dukkha. Mm. And we suffer. Why we suffer? Because we are clinging into something that we should not. And because we don't know that we should not attach and expect something that is not realistic. The reality being destroyed and not back, and that's why we suffer. They just explain it from a simple term, okay? And so how do we let go or escape from that condition then? Then first we have to realize that what the trouble we are into. And so the path of the Four Noble Truths recognize the trouble, the peak we are in, and so, and its cause, what is the cause? Because we are clinging to something that's so unrealistic. And so once you have that, then you know the issue and we can start developing the way that we will let go of that unrealistic attachment and clinging. And basically that is the Four Noble Truths in 2 minutes.
So, one, two, three, four.
Well, the formula inside the Pali Canon translated in English is now indeed, because what is the noble truth of suffering? Birth to is suffering, aging to is suffering, sickness to is suffering, death to is suffering. Being separated from what is dear to is suffering. Being joined with what is disliked is suffering. Not getting what one wishes for to is suffering. In short, the five clumps of clinging are suffering. Now indeed, because what is the noble truth of the origin of suffering? Whatever craving that leads to further existence comes with delight and passion and indulges in this and that. That is to say, craving for sensual pleasures, craving for existence, and craving for non-existence. Now, indeed, because what is the noble truth of the cessation of suffering? It is the remainderless fading away and cessation, renunciation and relinquishment of that very craving, freedom from it and non-reliance on it. Now, indeed, because what is the noble truth of their way leading to the cessation of suffering? It is just this noble eightfold way consisting of right worldview, right motivation, right speech, right action, right livelihood, right endeavor, right composure, and right integration.
And you'd get a longer version of that next week during the second part of the
Please don't get enlightenment just yet.
Thank you for taking
this
on.
Thank you. Thank you so much.
Thank you very much.
And I think that was a very good overview and certainly gives us an overview about Theravada Buddhism in terms of the structure. But even through the discussion today, I think it's very clear that Theravada itself is not just one coherent teaching technique that you can take away with you. And all, as much as humans we like to have that coherency, you won't find that in any of the traditions, actually. And as we go through, you'll start to see that even within each of the traditions, there are differences. There are different traditions within the traditions. And that's okay. And I think as practitioners, we need to be aware of that, rather than to have this idealistic expectation that there is this coherency that we can tap right with us. But rather, this is the whole point of this course, to actually start to unravel what are those differences and to learn more for ourselves in a practical and experiential way what that actually means for our practice. And I've taken some notes already about some of the things that I'll be asking Jim to speak on next week. So, for example, our discussion about the goal is the bodhisattva paths towards Buddhahood, is the goal arahantship. You know, even something so fundamental, there is a distinction between the traditions and within the traditions. So that's something I think we should explore. Is the goal nibbana? What does that actually mean? And speaking to different people from different traditions, even that itself is different. Something as fundamental as the Four Noble Truths, the Noble Eightfold Path, you'll think, often we speak about that as something that is common to all the traditions. You know, it's actually not. And part of the reason why is because over the years, Buddhism has travelled many countries, it's travelled through many eras, and also translation. You just heard that a lot of the teachings was passed down orally and also passed down in a different language. So as it's translated, then people put different interpretations on it. And we have to be realistic about that. So even just now, in terms of Bhante Jason sharing that particular translation, you may read the same translation, the same sutta, differently. And that gives a different slant to it as well. So over time, these differences arise. And part of what we need to do as practitioners is to see how to make it real for us. So I've taken some notes, and if there is anything else that you're interested in after hearing today's talk, please bring your questions along for GTO next week. And then after that, we will have two sessions on Tibetan Buddhism by Robert Tomic. And so I hope to see you all there as well. Thank you. Good night.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Bye.